Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. Welcome to those who are in person here in the room. I am really, really ecstatic to finally have learning going on face-to-face in the same space. For those who are online, I hope that at some point that will change and you'll venture to be here with us in person. But we are going to continue to offer the hybrid option, God willing, until the end of this year, the academic year, not the calendar year. Just a note, I mentioned this to a couple of people who were here before, hybrid classes are really hard because those who are in the room can't hear clearly the comments of the people who are online, and people who are online tend to have difficulty hearing the comments of those who are in the room. So, you know, that's just, that's the nature of it. So what we do is I'm going to try, to the extent possible, to repeat comments made by people online for those who are in the room and to repeat the comments of those who are in the room for those who are online. In the event that at some point I forget to do so, just remind me. It's as simple as that. Just remind me and I will, and I'll do my best with it. It's the sort of thing where when you're looking at the people who are on the screen, it's harder to remember also the people who are in the room and vice versa. So I may slip at some point. Just remind me, I will not be insulted in the least. We are in Perek Vav. We're in chapter 6. Already a question. Yes.
A question, a comment. I would like the people in the room to remember that you're not muted.
Okay. Don't worry about it. The people in the room, I will not say to you at any point, you're muted.
Yes, but I
understood. Understood. And if people could silence cell phones, that would actually be really helpful. Those online also. So I thought we would start with a review of where we've been since we've been off for the last couple of weeks. And then we'll be able to pick up from there. And it's going to be a quick review. You can see it on the sheet. I do plan to go back to bringing some hard copies, but really those who develop a habit of printing out their own while on Zoom, you know, if you want to start printing out your own for this session, that would be great too. We began way back when, after Sukkot, with Shlomo, as I wrote on the sheet, publicly identified as the next one in line, the next to become the king. That's funny. Yeah, no, what I wrote on here, I didn't edit well. Solomon was publicly identified as the next time in the time of King David. That doesn't make any sense. I meant the next king in the line of King David. I don't know what I was doing when I wrote that. But in any case, he's identified in the beginning of the book as the next king. And that's something that they've actually known for a long time. Oh, I know what I wrote there. Okay. He was publicly identified for a long time. Going back to the time of King David, he was identified as the next king. That was the point that I wanted to make, that if you read the account in Divrei HaYamim, in Chronicles, you find King David publicly announcing that Shlomo is going to be the next king and that Shlomo is going to build the Beis HaMikdash. Everybody knew. And yet, we get to the opening chapter of Malachim and we find that David is very, very ill, perhaps on his deathbed. That's less clear in the story, but he's certainly very, very ill. And his brother Adoniyahu takes advantage of that illness to campaign. He holds a great big party at a fun place down by the water and attracts people who ultimately would support him, if it got that far, for the throne. Natan the prophet comes to Bathsheba, Shlomo's mother, and says, you got to do something. Here's what you should do. She changes the directions a little bit, but she comes to King David and she tells him, you know, you have a problem here. This is, Adoniyahu is going to be the next king if you don't do something, and I'm going to be in trouble, and my son Shlomo is going to be in trouble. And David intervenes. He says, no, Shlomo is the next king, and he makes Shlomo king in his lifetime while David is still alive. Adoniyahu is brought before Shlomo, and Shlomo says, if you'll be a good boy, you can live. Those are my terms. That brings us to chapter 2. And in chapter 2, David actually is on his deathbed. And at that point, he instructs Shlomo to get rid of or to make sure they don't die peacefully, the following people. He tells him that he's going to have to take care of Yoav, who had been the general who killed Avner. He should take care of Shimi ben Gera, who was a prophet, it appears, or a scholar. I'm trying to keep track of both groups, the online and the in-person, and it's making me fuzzy. But we'll be okay. It's just a transition period in trying to do this. He's supposed to take care of Shimi ben Gera. Shimi ben Gera was the one who cursed David when he was on the run from Avshalom, as well as he's supposed to help Barzilai. Barzilai HaGiladi was an ally of King David who helped him at the time of Avshalom's revolt. So Shlomo ends up eliminating Eviatar. Eviatar was Kohen Gadol. He was a survivor of the city of Nov. But he had gone bad. He had supported Adoniyahu. Shlomo got rid of him. Shlomo got rid ultimately of Yoav and Adoniyahu as well. Adoniyahu tried to convince Bathsheba that he should be allowed to marry Avishag Shunamit, who had been the nursemaid for David. And Shlomo ends up getting rid of Adoniyahu. Shlomo gets rid of Shimi ben Gera when Shimi ben Gera breaks the terms of his exile. There's more to be said about all of this. I feel like I'm botching it by trying to say it too quickly. I'm just trying to give a flavor, at least, of what happened. But fundamentally, what this means is that Shlomo has gotten rid of threats to his peaceful reign. Chapter 3 began with Shlomo apparently marrying the daughter of the Pharaoh, which is a no-no. You're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to marry an Egyptian. Remember, the Egyptians are not allowed to marry in for 3 generations. We had a long discussion about what he did and why this was okay. And the answer in brief is that it's not okay, according to most commentators. Abarbanel made a mighty attempt to try to justify what Shlomo did. But in the end, it's basically understood that no, maybe it was a shogeg, it was by mistake, but he seems to have violated the law by doing so. The big question is, did he marry her at that point, or does he marry her later when he dedicates the Beis HaMikdash? Because when we get to the dedication of the Beis HaMikdash, we'll see texts that seem to indicate the marriage happens later, but it is recorded in the beginning of chapter 3. He's also not yet built the Beis HaMikdash, even though he is now in the 4th year of his reign. And even though David had said Shlomo was supposed to build it. And we said at the time that the text, by noting this, may be criticizing Shlomo, that he has done something wrong. Later on, not today, but hopefully next week, maybe the week after, we'll see justifications for why Shlomo waited. But, sorry? He may have been young. In the Medrash, we're taught that Shlomo is 12 years old at the time when he takes over. We noted that that's difficult. Abarbanel said, no, he's got to be at least 20. Nonetheless, you're right, that possibility is certainly there, that he's very young when he starts. He brings offerings to God at the Mishkan and receives a prophetic promise, or perhaps it wasn't prophetic, depends on whether you believe Shlomo qualified as a prophet or not. We had a nice discussion about that. But God promises him, I'm going to give you whatever you want. And Shlomo asks for wisdom. He wants to be able to judge the people well. And along with that, he gets wealth, he gets honor, and God says, you will have a long time on the throne if you remain loyal to God. And that chapter concluded with the story of the two women, with the baby, and the question of whose baby it was, and Shlomo figures it out, and everybody's very impressed, and we had a nice long discussion about what was so brilliant about Shlomo's solution, and how it was that he figured it out. We're not revisiting this, just again, making sure that we remember the basics of the storyline. That led us to chapter 4. And chapter 4 illustrates Shlomo's wisdom as an administrator, taking care of the country's needs. He manages the needs of the food for him and his entourage and the palace without depleting any resources within the nation. Everybody seems to be doing well and everybody seems to be happy. And that continued into chapter 5. Shlomo's wisdom was visible. in the way that he ran his government, his negotiations with King Hiram of Tsor, who was going to provide materials, at the least, for the Beis HaMikdash. But we noted that he is amassing great wealth, and he is amassing horses. And if you remember, in Devarim chapter 17, we were warned, kings have to avoid that. And there may be some problems already seen in Shlomo's reign. That's the first five chapters. I'm going to pause for a second for questions, but I don't want this to occupy a lot of our time. I just wanted to make sure that we remember where we've been. Questions from the group online? No questions from those in person? Okay. For reference, we have 18 people plus myself online and about an equal number in person. All right. We have six plus me in person. Fair enough. So that brought us to the beginning of chapter 6. And we started on this last time when we noted that chapter 6, sentence 1, those who are using the art scroll Tanakh, I'm remembering this now. I used to keep that with me so I could also announce page numbers from there. But I think we'll be okay. But in the opening sentence of chapter 6, we were told that it's 480 years after the Jews leave Egypt, in the month of Iyar, which is known in the text as Ziv, that Shlomo starts to build the Beis HaMikdash. And we asked, why did we count from the departure from Egypt? And one approach was, that's normal. We're supposed to count from when we leave Egypt. Only once the Beis HaMikdash is built do we start to count from its construction. So that's one approach. Another approach is that, no, we're trying to say this was the fulfillment of a process that began when we left Egypt. Right? We talked about it on Pesach. We sang Dayenu. And the goal at the end of that process is for us to come to our land. So that's it. We've completed it. It took us 480 years because, you know, we're Jews. We're a little slow at times. But we made it. And we have the Beis HaMikdash, and we're thrilled to be in this state. Okay. And that brings us to our beginning of new material. Now, we're going to be seeing in chapter 6 and chapter 7 the construction of the Beis HaMikdash, as well as certain other buildings that Shlomo used. Realistically, I think we have something like 8 weeks left in the schedule. We have every Tuesday until mid-June, except for the day after Shavuos. So we don't have enough time to spend as much time as I would like on the construction itself and all the little details that are brought in the Beis HaMikdash. Nonetheless, I do plan to discuss some of it, because there are some things there that you have to see if you're learning these chapters. So we'll see some of it. We're not going to spend a lot of time on it. I'm mindful of the fact that our overall arc is Shlomo's arc. Some of that is reflected in the construction of the Beis HaMikdash, but to a certain extent, it's really outside of the building itself. So take a look, please, at chapter 6, sentence 2. V'habayis asher bana ha-melech Shlomo l'Hashem. The house Shlomo built for God was 60 amma orko, 60 amos long. Okay, an amma, usually rendered as approximately 21.6 inches, for those who are using inches. For those who are using the metric system, I wish you luck. But it's somewhere between a foot and a half and 2 feet. Is an amma. So it is huge. 60 amos long. The esrim rochbo, 20 amos wide. Ushloshim amma komaso, and 30 amos tall. It's a nice size building, right? That's my impression at any rate. It's a nice size building. What's particularly interesting, though, is that it is not the same set of dimensions as the Mishkan. The Mishkan's dimensions are smaller than the Beis HaMikdash. And so one of the questions that we need to address is, why does it look different from the Mishkan? The Mishkan was not only a temporary building like you would have, you know, you would say, well, it's 40 years in the wilderness. They used the Mishkan in Shiloh, just in Shiloh, for, I think we said, 369 years. Aside from the period when it was in Gilgal, aside from the period in Nov and Givon, like hundreds and hundreds of years, you used a Mishkan. Why are you completely blowing up that design in favor of something new? That's a key question that we have to ask. And along with it, we have to ask another question, which is, the text said Shlomo built this building. I'm going to stipulate that Shlomo was not the only one who was involved with the hammers and the nails and the chisel. Well, there are no nails, but the Shlomo was not the one who was physically building this building. And indeed, we know about the wood he's getting from Tzor, and we're going to learn about other people who are involved in the work. Not to mention, I think we said from the end of chapter 5 that he had laborers who were involved. So when it says Shlomo built it, that doesn't mean Shlomo physically built it. I mean, he's the one who led the charge. But who designed the Beis HaMikdash? Who actually decided what this should look like? So I think we started on this in the last week that we learned before Pesach, but now we're going to spend some real time on this topic, and that's what we're going to spend time on in the next, for the next, I don't know, 20 minutes or so probably. Take a look on your sheet, please, at source number 1. This is from Divrei Hayamim Aleph, the end of Divrei Hayamim Aleph. Not the very end, but like the last couple of chapters. Chapter 28. And here we are told, Vayitein David l'Shlomo v'no es tavnis ha'ulam v'yezbatav v'gin zakav v'aliyosav v'chadarav ha'pnimim. David gave to Shlomo the structure of the ulam. Ulam is a major room we're going to have to talk about probably next week. And the batim, the rooms. Gin zakav, the places for storage. Aliyosav, the upper floors. Chadarav ha'pnimim, the inner rooms. All of these things, David gives Shlomo the plans. And not only the plans, but as the text continues, David divides up the Kohanim and Leviim into their shifts. He gives Shlomo gold. I'm just, you know, looking at the passages that I brought you here on the sheet. He gives him gold that he's going to use for all sorts of implements, for the menorot, for tools, for the mizbeach on which incense is brought. And it concludes, Hakol biksav miyad Hashem, all in writing from the hand of God, alai hiskil kol malachos hatavnis. He gave me the insight for all of these designs. So David knows it from God. So as we discussed last time that we met, before Pesach, the Midrashim treat this as an actual scroll that David had that was given to him with the text. And it was passed down across generations. And I brought you in source number 2. We read it last time. I'm not going to read it again now, but I wanted it for everybody to be able to have it in front of them. The Medrash Shmuel says that this scroll was actually recording a tradition that Hashem gave to Moshe. God gave it to Moshe, Moshe gave it to Yehoshua, Yehoshua gave it to the sages, who gave it to the prophets, who gave it to David, and David gave it to Shlomo, and that's what the text meant in source number 1, when it said that he gave him the form and all of that. He was literally telling Shlomo, here is how you are going to build the Beis HaMikdash, such that source number 3 is a Gemara in Erevin, which asks a very interesting question. I'm going to pause for questions soon, so hang in there. There is a Mishnah which says that they were concerned about a slipping hazard on the ramp for the Mizbeach, for the altar, in the Beis HaMikdash. There's a lot of liquid, right? The blood is there. Water sukkahs time, but there's wine. There, unfortunately, there's a risk of slipping on this ramp. So what did they do? They scattered salt on the ramp in order for the Kohanim to have traction. So the Gemara in Erevin asks, Rav Acha Breda Rava says to Rav Ashi, wait a minute, what are you doing with this salt? If you scatter the salt and you let it remain, then you're actually adding to the structure of the ramp. And you're not allowed to do that. As noted in parentheses, they quote our verse, it's all given from God. That's the structure. But on the other hand, if you're not saying that the salt is going to remain there on the ramp, then that means the salt is going to constitute an interruption between the surface and the feet of the Kohanim. Meaning the Kohanim have to stand flat on the floor. So what are you doing? Either you're adding to the structure illegally, or you're not adding to the structure, in which case there's an interruption. And so they deal with the question. But my point in bringing this is to show how seriously the Gemara views this idea that every detail of the construction has been passed down and you're not allowed to add. You don't get to mess with the construction. Now, we know that in the Second Temple time that wasn't the case, because Herod did an awful lot of messing with the Second Temple construction. Like, at some point they are adding, but this description is going back to the First Temple, the first Beis HaMikdash, and asking how could you do that? Similar question comes up. You may be familiar with the practice that they had for the Simchas Beis HaShoeva on Sukkot, right? You had the big celebration of the water drawing, and everybody would come to watch, and there was a big celebration, there was juggling and all of that, and they created a raised platform so that the men and the women would be standing in different areas. And the Gemara in Sukkah asks, who gave you the right to do that? You were not allowed to change the structure in the Beis HaMikdash. And again, they need to come up with a justification to explain how it was that they were able to do that. In source number two, the Yerushalmi in Megillah actually says, that's funny, it says source number two. Yeah, I don't know. I think because I was racing to do this sheet before Pesach, so I got all the chametz out, but I missed the numbers. But it's four, but whatever. It's Yerushalmi in Megillah still. And it teaches us that they actually understood these instructions that were given to Shlomo were meant to be analyzed in order to draw lessons from them. It was viewed as halacha. The idea that there was an old tradition for how to build the Beis HaMikdash makes a lot of sense. First of all, in Devarim chapter 12, we were told there is going to be a central site. I gave you a reference in source number 3 to the verses, but I don't want us to spend time on looking them up right now. But in Devarim chapter 12, we are told God is going to choose a place. That will be the central site, and everybody will go there in order to bring their sacrifices. So you always knew that was going to be the case, and it was supposed to become a permanent location, not like the Mishkan, which is portable and ends up moving from place to place for one reason or another, but rather it's supposed to become Menucha and Nachala. It's supposed to become a set place where all the Jews go for all time, and it would seem to need a set of instructions. Remember the Mishkan? Right? We had a full set of instructions when it came to the Mishkan. We spend an awful lot of time on those instructions and then saying, and they did exactly this and they did exactly that. So with the Mishkan, we are given full instructions. So presumably they're going to be instructions for the Beis HaMikdash. It's not just going to be, yeah, you can wing it this time. Right? The first time I wanted to tell you exactly what you should use. Now you can just do it yourself. It doesn't make any sense. Not only that, this Mikdash is not being created in a vacuum. It's replacing the Mishkan. You can't just do that. You need some kind of prophetic authority to replace. The Mishkan has in it still Moshe's altar, right? We learned about that in chapter 3, that Shlomo brought his offerings to God on the altar that Moshe made. You have the Aron, the Ark. How in the world are you just going to, you know, say, well, now we've decided we wanted to renovate? It doesn't work that way. You need to have a set of instructions, and especially when you recognize that Shlomo did make some changes. Take a look at source number 4, please. And again, this is the second number 4. This is brought in Rashi on the Torah at the end of Parshas Yisro. Don't be scared when you see the word Elohei on there. It's not the name of God. It means God's lowercase g. It's talking about statues and idols. The Torah says, Lo sa'asun iti Elohei chesed ve'Elohei zahav lo sa'asu lachem. Don't make with me gods of silver and gods of gold. That's what the Torah warns about. Hashem says, don't make gods of silver and gods of gold. The text is odd because we already know the Ten Commandments. Number two, right? You shouldn't have other gods and you're not supposed to make other... Like, why do I need this text? So Rashi explains that's not what it's talking about. Elohei Chesed. Bala has here al hakruvim shata osela amod iti. It's talking about the cherubs that you're going to make to stand with me, los hasun iti, shaloyu shakesef, that they should not be made of silver, shimshinisam lasosam shakesef harehin lefanaike elohus. If you change, you're supposed to make the kruvim, the cherubs should be of gold. You make them of silver. It's like you made a foreign god. Velo hezahav, and don't make gods of gold either, teaches me you're not supposed to add to the kruvim. You have the two kruvim, the two cherubs, and that's it. Now that's a problem. I don't know how many of you took advantage of the break to read ahead in Malachim. But take a very fast look in our chapter. Chapter 6, sentence 20, I think it's 22? No, it's a little further. Yeah, 23. And there we find that Shlomo makes two more kruvim. Right? You see that? Two more cherubs. Those are not the cherubs that existed. The cherubs that existed are still there, on top of the Aron, on top of the ark. These are two new cherubs made of wood. They're going to be coated with gold. But I'm told here, you're not supposed to do that. So there must be some kind of justification. And the justification that we're getting here is, he was given a set of instructions. That's the justification. More evidence that there was a set of instructions. If you take a look at source number 5 on your sheet, this is the first number 5, I think. Yes. I know I'm monologuing a lot, though. But let's get through this unit first. If you take a look at source number 5, this is a passage from Shmuel Beis, in which we are told that David conquered Hadad Ezer and he got gold shields and he brought them to Yerushalayim. And he also got a lot of copper. I'm paraphrasing because I didn't bring the translation on the sheet. I'm just paraphrasing it. The specifics are not as germane as the fact that he takes the gold that he has conquered. He's taking the copper that he has gotten. He's taking silver as well. And what does he do with all of it? He dedicates it to Hashem. And he dedicates it for use in the Beis HaMikdash that they are going to build. Now, we know he acquired the site of the Beis HaMikdash. That's the second part of source number 5. But we are now also being told that he set aside materials. Well, if he did that, that must mean he had plans. How do you set aside materials if you don't know what you're building? So there has to be a set of instructions that they already have. How specific, exactly what, we don't know. But there is something that we are referring to in Divrei Hayamim, which is going to serve as the blueprint for what Shlomo is going to build. So what to sum up what we said in the last 10 minutes or so, Shlomo is the one who is listed as the builder of the Beis HaMikdash, but he's not the hands-on builder. And he can't be making it up as he goes along. The plans that he is working from, the Medrash says, based on the line in Divrei Hayamim, where we are told that it was Miyad Hashem, from the hand of God, the answer is the prophets had given David, who gave Shlomo, the instructions for what this temple, what this Beis HaMikdash is supposed to look like. Okay, I'm going to take questions first from those in the room and then from those online. Thank you, everybody, for waiting patiently. Debbie.
So anything that Shlomo does that is not on spec, his excuse is God said I could. The reason I'm doing this is God has already told me I can do this. That's it.
So to repeat for those online, Debbie says, so every time Shlomo deviates from what the Jews had done before, the answer is God told me to.
And who's going to argue with him?
Right. And the answer is that's why he's the smartest man in the room. Other questions and comments from those in the room? Okay, those online. Ruchama.
If I'm not mistaken, the first kruvim Bezalel did.
Correct.
And what did they do with it?
So they're still there. They're still there on top of the Aron. These Kruvim are not standing on the Aron. We'll learn about them next week, I hope. Yeah. Ruchama asked what happened to the first set of Kruvim, and the answer is they're still there. Those are on the lid, the kaporet, the lid of the ark. Shlomo's are not standing on top of the ark. Shlomo's are standing on the floor. But we have to talk more about them, God willing, next week. You'll see. We'll talk more about it. Ruth, you were going to say?
I have trouble with the Kruvim from the get-go.
Yes.
More Kruvim, it's just more trouble.
Yeah. No, it's very true. Ruth points out that these Kruvim, these cherubs, are trouble. As a matter of fact, we are taught in a Medrash that at the time when the enemies of the Jews come into the Beis HaMikdash, when they're going to destroy it, they look at the cherubs and say, you're idolaters just like us. Look what's in your Holy of Holies. Now, we also have to have a separate question of what are Kruvim. We always assume that they are, you know, little babies, Cupids, right? Because they're that's what we think of as a cherub. It's a possibility, but it's also a possibility that they're oxen.
What? Oxen?
Debbie said, what? Just in case those online didn't hear. Yes, oxen.
An oxen, a little thing that flies around with wings and a halo.
No, little thing, just oxen with wings.
Oh, oxen
the, with wings. I think like golden calf, right?
Yeah.
We'll see. We have to talk about that. But the etymology of the word kruv lends itself potentially to the idea that it's an ox.
They're not seraphim.
No, seraphim are their own brand of angel.
Okay.
These are kruvim, right? No, each brand of angel has its own trademark. Yeah, they get their own name. Other questions from those online? Yes, Ricky.
When you say oxen, I'm thinking of the horns. Is that what people would grab on if they wanted to be saved from?
Right. So it's not. Ricky asked about if they're oxen, they have horns, and we talk about grabbing onto the horns of the altar. But no, that's talking about the horns of the altar, which is in an external room. It's not in the Holy of Holies. And what it means there is the corners of the altar, which jutted out. They actually protruded from the ark, and that's what you hold on to. Remember, the word keren can mean horn. It can also mean corner. So that's the reference to what they would hold on to. Other questions from those online? Okay. Question here. Why doesn't the book of Shmuel record this level of detail? Meaning, it tells us what I noted for you in source number 5, that David dedicated materials. Why didn't it give me details about the plans? Why did it only tell me about the materials and not go any further? Why didn't you give us, like, you know, a lot to work with? So Toby says, David is not going to be the one to build it. And in that, she agrees with Don Isaac Abarbanel. Take a look at source number 7, please. Abarbanel's introduction to Shmuel writes the following. In the interest of time, I'm just going to read out my English translation. You have the original Hebrew there as well. The prophet did not see fit to mention the instruction of building the Beis HaMikdash for Solomon, his son, and all Israel, and the form of the work assigned to Solomon, and the number of Levites and the division into shifts for the work in the Beis HaMikdash and the other items mentioned regarding the Beis HaMikdash. None of that makes it into Shmuel. Some of it makes it into Divrei Hayamim, but not into Shmuel. Why not? Because he saw fit to ascribe the entire construction of the Beis HaMikdash to Solomon, his son, not to David, not in deed, instruction, or preparation, because God desired that it be built via Solomon. David's not the builder, so don't link it to him. When Ezra comes along and he writes Divrei Hayamim, he wants to make sure that everybody knows this came from David, because it's very important to Ezra to legitimize the entire Davidic line. But Shmuel has no interest in doing that. Shmuel's not actually the prophet who writes this part of Shmuel. This part of Shmuel is written either by Natan or by God. But Natan is the one who said, David, you're not building it. So we're not going to now list it as though David did. And that's going to come back later on, not this week, but eventually when we talk about what happened to the materials that David dedicated for the construction of the Beis HaMikdash. So let me ask one more question about this whole construction and about the differentiation between the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash. it's all well and good, and I can accept without any problems that God gave them a set of instructions, and that because God gave a set of instructions, that overrode whatever was in the Mishkan. But why didn't you keep the Mishkan structure? It was good for hundreds of years. Why did you need to make the Beis HaMikdash different from the Mishkan? What's this about? Why change? What would you say? Those in the room first? Yeah, Ruth. Right. So Abarbanel is apparently a favorite of those in the room, because we're going to come back to that idea. But Ruth says, you're shifting from that which was portable to that which is going to be permanent. So I'm going to come back to that idea. Actually, why come back to it? Why not just note it, since we just said it? Take a look. I'm jumping on the sheet to source number 10. He says, Shlomo nis'atzei me'od la'asos binyan abayis b'kiyum mufla. Shlomo worked hard to make this a marvelous construction. Im mipa'asa avanim, shayu avanim gedolos, avanim yakaros, avnei gazis, with the stones that were large and that were valuable and that were mined from the, that were gazit. I translated here as, oh, you know what? I didn't. I know why I did it the way I did it. It's because of an issue that we're not up to yet. I'm just leaving it the way it's written here. Eternal mind from the boulder. La'ad batzur yechet savun. Ve'im ipa'as ha'itzim shayu eitz erez shlayikanez bo ipush b'shum zman. As well as the wood for which he used cedar wood, which would not rot. He says, "V'chol ze haya leman ya'amdu ha'devarim ha'hem kimei ha'shamayim al ha'aretz." The idea was, this should be eternal. It's not, the Mishkan is good as a portable building for temporary use. It's not what he has in mind for the long term. Other thoughts as to why we're deviating here? Moish, and then Sandra.
All right, this is going to blow everybody's mind.
I am sure.
Okay, no, sure.
Those in the room heard that. How did you hear that? Yeah, go ahead.
That means everybody's smiling. You know, I was always bothered by Dayenu, because at the end of Dayenu it says, Bonolotus Base Habachira. You know, what is that about?
What do you mean?
Simple translation is that the Base HaMikdash is a base of Habachira. It's true, it could relate to God, but it doesn't necessarily. In fact, it's funny how the Knesset is about Bechirot.
No, but I have a different problem. The word Beis HaBechira comes from the fact that Hashem calls it Hamakom Asher Yivchar.
Well, but that's the point. Dayenu doesn't say that. I know what you're saying, and I'm actually looking at that pasuk. And you would think that, but so what's this bit about Dayenu? Beit HaBechira is, and this is the whole point, this is why they changed the Beit HaMikdash, because it is a place of ultimate choice. Of course, it's true about God, but it's far more than that. It's about your choice.
But if you're changing it based on a prophetic text, then you didn't choose anything.
I'm sorry?
If you're changing it based on a text you received prophetically, then you didn't actually choose anything.
You know, you can
if you don't accept the narrative of the scroll, then that's a different story. But I'm working on that basis, because David said so in Divrei Hayamim. Hakol b'ksav yad miyad Hashem. It came from God. I'm good with that. Okay, Sandra.
Simply, in the Midbar, they didn't have a king. Once they had a king, then the king needs a palace, not a tent.
So Sandra suggests that it's because you now have a king, which you didn't have before, and therefore you need it to be more palatial. But I will note that in chapter 7, we're actually going to find Shlomo's palace as a separate structure. This building does not get that kind of stamp of being Shlomo's palace. It's true, you do have a king.
No, I don't mean that it's his. I'm saying in the Mishkan, there was no king. Once
right.
you have a king in their own country, then you need a more permanent structure.
I hear you. They say so you need that more permanent structure because you have a king and because you have a country. I hear you. Are people in the room able to hear those online? Yeah. Okay, that's good. That's helpful then. I'm going to suggest a couple of other ideas. All right, I'll take Ricky, and then I'm going to suggest a couple of other ideas.
Yes, and I think that because the Beit HaMishkan was temporary, because it was moving, I think it stated in one of the commentaries, this is permanent, and they're expecting more people. Now that there is a country, they're expecting more people to come and worship and participate in everything.
Right, so that's in line with Abarbanel. It needs to be larger, it needs to be more permanent. I definitely would agree. Just to add to that, since we saw number 10, take a look at numbers 11 and 12. The Rambam, in his Hilchos Beis HaBechira, writes, U'mitzvah min amuvchar, the ideal mitzvah is l'chazek es habinyan, to strengthen the house, u'lahagbiho kifi kalach hatzibur, and to elevate it according to the community's power. And he quotes you the pasuk in Ezra, l'romei mes beis elokeinu, to elevate the house of our God. Umefarin oso, they make it glorious. Umiyapin kifi kochan, they beautify it according to what they can do. Imichol latuachoso bezav ulagdilo b'masav, hareze mitzvah. If they can line it with gold, if they can elevate that which they've created for it, that is a mitzvah. And in fact, I brought you in source number 12. After the Hasmoneans defeat the Greeks, they build a new menorah. But initially they make it with iron rods, and they coat it with tin. Don't ask me why you're coating it with tin. Maybe, I guess, because the iron oxidizes, so does your tin really protect it?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay. So they coated it with tin. What do I know? But they became wealthier, and then they made it out of silver, and then they became wealthier, and they made it out of gold. So they work their way up. And that's one explanation for why they make it differently. You could suggest a couple of other avenues. Take a look on your sheet, go backwards in the sources, to the Radbaz, Rabbi David Ibn Abi Zimra. Radbaz was a major halachic authority in the 16th century. He lived in a couple of places, but I think he's best known for his time in Egypt. And someone challenged him about those kruvim, the cherubs that Shlomo built, and what they're doing there. So look at what he says here as part of his answer. He says, and I'm going to go with my English translation in the interests of time. He says to the questioner, you asked regarding what Rashi wrote in Parshas Yisro, that was what we already saw, that you're not supposed to be adding cherubs, and you're bothered, Shlomo added two. His answer is, first of all, he says, this is not Rashi, but a Mechilta. Mechilta is halachic medrash that says that you're not supposed to add cherubs. So it's not Rashi's invention in the 11th century. This is old halachic medrash that says you're not supposed to add. And you must know that all that Shlomo did was via prophecy as conveyed to his father David, all in writing from the hand of God, as we noted already from the verse in Divrei Hayamim. God gave him insight. All of the design, as we have seen, that he made other altars, we'll talk about that, and menorot, and tables, and other vessels. But he did not make another ark. He never made a new Aron. The Aron was original. And he made two other cherubs, 10 cubits tall, their wings high over the ground and over Moshe's cherubs, as explained in the text. Radbaz says, the answer is, God told him to. Why did God do it? Why does God do whatever God does? That's just what God wanted. That's all. That's an approach. And then you find, in later Midrashim, an approach which goes change by change instead of giving an overarching answer. Instead of saying, well, this is permanent, or now you have a king and it has to be more majestic, or saying it's what God wanted overall, let me wipe away all my problems that way. Late Midrashim, and when I say late Midrashim, I mean Midrashim that are only canonized in, call it the 8th, 9th, 10th century, they look at specific changes and say, this was for this reason, this change was for that reason, and they tend to associate it with the prayers that we are offering to God. So as an example, take a look at source number 9, Medrash recorded in the Otzar Midrashim. And he made 10 tables, Vayashulchanot Asara. Shlomo had in addition to the original Shulchan, the table in the Mishkan, he made 10 more. So there were 11 tables. Lots of tables. Why did he do that? Kedei laharbos zira'im. In order to increase seeds, meaning so that the plants should grow well. When you bring the bread on the Shulchan, on the table, in the Mishkan, and then in the Beis HaMikdash, it's a prayer for Parnassa, for the nation. You're praying to God, bless that which we have planted. So, hey, one table brings this much blessing. 11 tables. Now we're going to have a lot more blessing. You know, I got more bread, more tables. The V'lama lo asa Moshe ela echad. So the Medrash says, why didn't Moshe think of that? Why doesn't Moshe make 10 tables? Why does Moshe make only one table? He doesn't say because God told Moshe to make only one. He says because you weren't planting anything in the Midbar. You were getting the mud. What difference does it make? So Moshe only needed one table. And then he goes on. Vayas minoros hazahav eser. He made 10 gold minorot. Why did he make 10 gold minorot? Keneged asara dibros. Because you have 10 commandments. What does one have to do with the other? Because the menorah, the light of the menorah, is always supposed to represent Torah. The menorah is on one side of the building. The shulchan is on the other side of the building. The menorah is in the north. The shulchan is in the south. The north is where you pray for wisdom. The south is where you pray for wealth. The Gemara actually talks about that, about angling yourself in one direction or another, even though you're supposed to daven towards Yerushalayim. Nonetheless, you angle yourself one way or the other way in order to pray for insight, or in order to pray for wealth. So Moshe makes 10 menorot parallel to the 10 commandments, and not only that, it gets even better. He keeps on going. Kol menorah yesh ba sheva neirot. Each menorah has 7 lamps. Hare ayin. Well, that's 70, right? 10 times 7 is 70. Keneged shivim umos, 70 nations. Shekolzmansha neros dolkos haumos miskabshin. Because as long as the lamps are burning, the nations are under control. They're not going to control you. Umiyom shekavu aneros misgabrin. And from the day the lamps were extinguished, the nations became more mighty and they defeated us. Vatara nimshala bener, and the Torah is compared to a lamp. And so on and so on. So they look at this and say, the idea is that each change reflect somehow something in our appeal to God, and you have to go through the changes then and ask, well, why this and why this and why this? That's the idea. Clear? Good? Okay, let's go further. The height of this building. This is a remarkable design element that really highlights the grandeur of the Beis HaMikdash. Anybody know, online or in the room, how tall the Mishkan was? It's explicit in the Torah. It's not like this isn't a trick question. The Mishkan is 10 amos tall. 10 cubits. 216 inches. That's the height of the Mishkan. Actually, I did look this up when I wrote it up in my notes. I did all my notes before Pesach. I forgot I did that. 5.5 meters is the height of the Mishkan. Here we learned that the Bayit is, this Beis HaMikdash, is 30 amos tall. 3 times the size of the Mishkan. Right? Those keeping score at home, 16 and a half meters, assuming my standard measure of 21.6 inches for an amma. But that is going to get dwarfed in a moment. Take a look at source number 13 from Divrei Hayamim. There is a room in the Beis HaMikdash complex, and we're going to talk about it more next week, I hope, called the Ulam. And we are told, V'ha'ulam asher al pnei ha'orech al pnei rochav habayis amos esrim, v'ha'gova me'a ve'esrim. You have this ulam, which is a chamber in front of the Beis HaMikdash, it seems. There's some discussion about its placement. Again, we'll talk about it, I hope, next week. But it is 120 amos tall. I mean, that's just, like, how do you even, like, explain that? Right? I mean, that's 66 meters.
Sounds like a church to me.
It does, doesn't it? They got their ideas somewhere, didn't they? In all seriousness.
No, I'm here.
Yeah. The ulam, by the way, is also mentioned in our chapter, but in our chapter it doesn't mention the height for it. It just mentions the length and the width. It's in chapter 6, sentence 3, that we mention the ulam here. So, so first of all, just noting, there's no contradiction between the bayit being 30 and the ulam being 120, meaning it's possible to argue there are two different rooms. And that's what Radak says, and that's what Ralbag says. Abarbanel, though, actually says, no, all the buildings were 120 amos. We're going to see that the Beis HaMikdash itself isn't one floor. The Beis HaMikdash is the main room, and then there are aliyot. There are rooms upon rooms on top of it. It's actually a four-story building, three- or four-story building. And so he says, you go up enough stories, and you reach 120 amos. That's the way that Abarbanel deals with it. I brought it for you in source number 14. You can see it there.
Can I just ask?
Yeah, Dahlia.
Is there a roof on any of this, or are these just...
All of it has roofs. All of it has roofs.
This is an enclosed
yes.
thing.
Yes.
That is this big.
Yep.
Because in order to structure a roof that is this big, you need infrastructure. You need arches.
Yes, you do.
Something. And when we make models of the Beis HaMikdash, none of this is ever apparent. How this roof stands such a big span.
So
there was no knowledge in those days. There weren't timbers that could go way across.
So there was, to be fair, architectural knowledge, and there were buildings that hit this kind of height in the ancient world. You did have it. The Gemara actually talks about this concern.
The Greeks had column after column after column because they didn't have arches. The arches were not invented until the Romans.
Okay.
There are no arches in here. The only way you can have a span that is this big is with an arch.
So,
by the time they built cathedrals, they had the Gothic cathedrals, which were arched, and they were supported with a lot of buttresses and to keep the walls from falling down. There's really no clear way to span any of this.
So I never thought
there was any room.
So what I can tell you is that the way that this is described here is, number one, extremely thick walls, and number two, beams which did not get nailed into a wall, but rather there were what's going to be called in the text migraot. And what that means is that your walls actually are sort of staggered, and the beam from each layer is resting on top of a wall rather than nailing into it. And I imagine that's giving it greater strength. But I'd encourage you to actually read through it.
I mean, as an architect and having taken structural engineering,
yes,
I cannot imagine how this is supposed to be accomplished.
Well, I'll ask you, as an architect, I'm going to put the challenge to you to read through it in terms of the description here, as well as in Divrei Hayamim. It's Divrei Hayamim Bet, chapter 3, I believe. Which is what I brought here, I referenced it in number 13. You'll see there the width of the walls, and maybe that is part of the secret of what they're doing. I can only tell you what I have in front of me, since obviously none of us saw it, and there are no photographs. And they're describing something as standing, so it's got to be doable. That's my, that's the perspective I'm bringing to
it.
No, no. Actually, the text will mention a roof. Did you read through this and in Divrei Hayamim? You should know all the models also have a roof. The models all have a roof. But yes, they.
So this big room, this ulam.
Yeah, Dahlia, I'm gonna have to move on here because we have 5 minutes left.
Okay.
So in terms of the Beis HaMikdash, this bayit being 30 amma tall for its first floor, right? Even if you take the view that everything is 120 ultimately, but the bayit is supposed to be 30 amma tall, as opposed to the Mishkan, which was only 10 amma tall. So why do you change from 10 to go to 30? So Abarbanel takes the view and I brought it for you in source number, no, I didn't end up bringing it there. Yeah, I brought it for you in source number 15. Abarbanel says the reason why you needed to make the Beis HaMikdash 30 Amma, 30 cubits, was because it was supporting the rooms above it. And therefore, it needed to be 30 cubits tall. I don't actually understand what that means. I'm recording what he says. In other words, the architects could probably explain this to me better. Why you're better off, maybe it's because of the height of the walls. I don't know. But that's Abarbanel's position on why they did it. The Malbim, on the other hand, if you look at source number 16, says, no, it's because of the meaning of it. He says, 10 cubits, it's a unit of Kedusha. It's a unit of holiness. There are levels of sanctity. And 10, you know, 10 is always the image of something that is complete. So he says, the Mishkan has one measure like that. The Beis HaMikdash is going to have triple that because there are three levels to the sanctity. He does not explain further what he means by the three worlds of sanctity that are involved, but that's the idea, which I think probably links to other comments of his on the three worlds, but here he doesn't say anything further. But the simplest explanation is the one we already said from Barbanel before, and Rabbi Yitzchak Levy reiterates it here in source number 17, which is to say, you're making it larger now because it is supposed to be grand, it is supposed to be permanent. In number 17, reading out my English translation, some of these changes express the transition from the initial and temporary, which the Mishkan displayed in the wilderness, the status of Erusin, or also known as Kiddushin, to the permanence of the Mikdash in the midst of the nation dwelling securely in its lands. This transition was expressed in enlargement of the space, addition of porches to the house itself, addition of cherubs, the change of materials, the increase of vessels, and other changes in the entire structure, as per the Rambam, which we noted before about making it more grand. So you're making this thing as big as you possibly can. That's the idea. You want to make this a glorious structure. And then you get the next element, and I know we only have 2 minutes to go, but I want to at least introduce it. And that is the use of what are described here as complete stones. Take a look at chapter 6, sentence 6, please. This gets us to what I described to Dahlia a couple of minutes ago, the migraot, the way that you have layers in the construction and how the walls are kind of staggered in such a way that the beams are going to rest on top of walls. So so you can see here, if you look at chapter 6, sentence 6, right? So the lowest one is 5 amma wide. When I say 5 amma wide, let's be clear. We mean the wall itself is 5 amma thick. And then the middle one is 6. And then the third one is 7. And he mentions that you have these migraot, that I mentioned before. The migraot is the grading of it so that it's inset. That's the idea. And those who have translations, you know what, just read out some of the translation. Read out the translation for 6:6. That'll be the way to make it the most clear. All right, read out.
The outermost story of the side structure was 5 cubits broad, and the middle was 6 cubits broad, and the third was 7 cubits broad. For on the outside, he made rebatements in the wall of the house.
Rebatements.
Abundance.
Now I know exactly what that is.
Recesses.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it is. It's a recessed wall. Right. Sorry?
Not abundance?
No, I think that I know that it's supposed to end up being a recess. The only question is how you get there. Oh, and you have a picture. Okay, so for those who can see that.
I would really like Lego rebuilding it here.
Yeah, Lego Beis HaMikdash, absolutely. So Toby has a picture, which those online aren't going to be able to see. But it's already 2:30, and I don't want to hold people late. But the point that we need to get to is actually sentence 7. Because in sentence 7, we're going to be told that the house is built of Eben Shlema, of complete stones. They're not cutting the stones. You don't hear any cutting going on when they're building the Beis HaMikdash. And the question that we're going to have to ask is, why? Why the insistence on having complete stones? Not to mention, we already saw a verse that mentioned Gazit, which we think means hewn stone. So are you cutting stones? Are you hewing stones, if you will, or not? So what I want to do next time is talk about that issue of the cutting of the stones. We'll talk about the shamir, which is something that some people here are probably familiar with. And then we're going to talk about some of these design features, the kruvim especially. Next week is a cherub week. So we have a lot to talk about. Thank you very much. Thank you to those who made it in person in particular. I'm very glad to be able to learn with people in the room. Those who are online, if you need to stay online, so be it. But if you can be here, it will be a great party. The day when we have 20 people here as opposed to 20 people on online. Thank you very much.